This is the Molecular Ecologist Podcast, a podcast about ecology, evolution, and everything in between. Each episode is a conversation with contributors to the Molecular Ecologist blog, and this episode is our first podcast version of the hashtag NewPI chat, an ongoing series of conversations between molecular ecologist contributors who are early career faculty at universities around the world. I'm Rob Denton, an assistant professor at the University of Minnesota Morris in Morris, Minnesota, and I'm here with...
I'm Stacey Kruger-Hadfield. I'm an assistant professor of biology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, and I'm finishing up my fourth year as an assistant professor.
And I'm Jeremy Yoder. I'm an assistant professor of biology at Cal State Northridge in Los Angeles, and this is my third year on faculty.
So let's start out talking a little bit about teaching loads and what we actually teach in the curriculum at our universities. I can start. I'm at a small public liberal arts university, which means my teaching load is relatively high. We do about 10 to 12 contact credits per semester. In practicality, that usually ends up being about one class with a lab, one class without a lab, and then usually something a little extra in addition to those things. I teach molecular biology, evolution, biological communications, and our introductory biology class as well.
So at UAB, I have a one-to-one teaching load. So I usually teach one course a semester. That's not how it's always worked out over the last couple of years. But typically, it's a lecture-based course. If you teach a lab, that would be considered an overload. And I teach courses that are cross-listed. So I have seniors and graduate students, and a lot of the courses that I teach are juniors or seniors, more upperclassmen. So I teach evolution, and evolution has seniors. It also has our capstone students, because we have a program where students write a thesis, and they can do that either doing research or in a course, and evolution is one of the courses that they can take as a capstone. And then I have master's or PhD students who are also in the course. So it makes it kind of challenging to teach. I also teach population genetics, I teach biometry, and I teach a science communication course. And biometry and science communication are only for graduate students.
The CSUs are closer to UM Morris. We've got a 12-hour commitment per semester, which works out for us to being something on the order of, that could be four largest lectures, that could be two lab lecture courses. We're the Northridge campus. We're pretty generous with reassigned time associated with departmental and campus service. And I've actually been enjoying the benefits of a pretty good, by CSU standards, startup reassigned time package. So I have never taught more than 6 contact hours in a semester up to this point. And actually my first semester I had no teaching, which was considered very unusual by colleagues. Rob, did you really hit the ground running with 12 first semester?
I had a 2-hour break for my first semester. So I taught, I didn't have the extra class on top of the others. But most of our, I don't know about the class sizes at CSU Northridge, but ours are very small. So they range anywhere from, 12 students to maybe my largest classes are 25 or 26.
Okay. Yeah, a 3-credit lecture course for us is something on the order of like 70 or 80 students.
Yeah.
That's typically what my evolution course would be. My population genetics course is much smaller. This semester I have 12 students, for example. But in the big, then that even the evolution course isn't that big of a course by UAB standards. We have some that are over 100 that are in big lecture halls for, introductory biology or genetics or something like that.
Yeah, this nomenclature that we use of a 4-4 or a 3-3, it makes no sense because it means such different things depending on where you are in terms of how, lab credit is assigned, or the sizes of classes probably makes a large difference. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know what those really mean, talking to other colleagues from other places.
Yeah, one of the best pieces of advice I got when I was on the job market was to really suss out what people were actually talking about when they talked about course load, because even just saying, oh, you have to do 4 courses a semester means totally different things depending on, we've already talked about class size and what counts, like, is the lab a separate course or is that all one ball of wax? And also support. So like, do you have TAs? Do you have a labs manager who is setting everything up for you? Or are you, planning experiments in advance too?
Sure. So, our experience, we're kind of this, a nice gradient from, so I'm the most junior of us going up, to Stacy. So could we talk about maybe how you made the transition from postdoc or teaching life before being a faculty member to teaching all these courses, and if you have strategies or lessons that you might have learned from that?
So I probably had the least teaching experience, because though I did my master's at Cal State Northridge, I did my PhD in Europe. And so where I did my PhD, there were no classes. I mean, when you took a class, it was a week long. You went somewhere and you listened to scientists come and give, you know, 45-minute seminars, not actual lectures. And so there wasn't an opportunity to TA. And then I did a postdoc in the UK, and I lectured occasionally, but even there, their modules are very different from like a 15-week semester type strategy that we would have at most universities in the US. And so I was a co-instructor of a phycology course when I was a postdoc in South Carolina. And that was the first experience I ever really had with actual lecturing and teaching. And I don't think it prepared me at all for what happened when I got to UAB. So I was fortunate at UAB. I taught my SciComm course the very first semester. And then the spring, we got one semester off. So everyone said, do the spring when your lab will be set up. My lab still wasn't set up in the spring, but it was better than twiddling my thumbs, you know, in the fall than teaching in the spring. And I was totally overwhelmed the first time I taught evolution. I'd never put together a course, and I was very fortunate that colleagues that in my department gave me all of their materials, so the two other people who taught evolution. So I had a lot to go with, but I still changed everything, which I think is pretty much what everyone always does. If you get slides and you think, oh great, I'll use these. And then you look at them and you realize, oh, there's pop culture references that I don't understand, so I can't use these slides. And I just had to dive straight in, and it meant that I don't think I got anything else done that fall, because I was preparing lectures the night before, and that's probably what happens to everyone, but I think I was really underprepared because I just never had the opportunity to TA because of where I did my dissertation. So I don't really know what prepared me. I just had to learn trial by fire.
I had essentially the same experience. I think I TA'd as a graduate student, so I had that experience of the back end of an American university. And I had a little bit of deliberate teaching experience as a postdoc, but that was in the form of basically adjuncting for a January term, very broad introductory biology course a couple years. And that was great because it was at least, you know, oh, I understand what it's like to try to fill up this amount of time and plan for a coherent sequence of things to happen. But it was not at all the same as sitting down and figuring out what a whole semester looks like, right? So I spent my first semester with complete teaching release and trying to get things, my ducks in a row in the lab. You know, I can think of ways that time could have been better spent, but it it worked out as well as it did. And part of what I was doing that semester was cramming as well, because my first course in my first spring semester was the class I'm teaching right now, which is flowering plant systematics. So botany, which is a lab lecture field course. 20 students, a lab experience, and some field trips over the course of the semester, and that counts for twice as many contact hours as my fall evolution lecture with 70 or 80 students. And so I, you know, I'm an evolutionary biologist who has studied plants a lot. I did not identify as a botanist before I was hired with the job description of plant evolutionary biologist. Yeah. And with the specific idea that I would take over this course. And I'd had, you know, a systematics course in graduate school, but I, there'd been, I think, two revisions to the angiosperm phylogeny group, canonical phylogeny, between then and when I started. And I had not done just field botany in Southern California, which is a global biodiversity hotspot, particularly for plants. So that first semester was interesting to say the least. And I certainly benefited from senior colleagues who, one of whom handed over a bunch of course materials and showed me some good resources around campus. I took that initial semester to try to brace for the impact of teaching, and it still ate my second semester. There was no limit to the amount of time I could spend preparing for a given day, and it somehow never felt like enough.
I had a lot of preparation for teaching during my graduate degree. Ohio State has a really nice graduate specialization in college university teaching that you can get, where you take
nice
pedagogy classes, and I had an opportunity to teach a course as an instructor of record. And so I felt comfortable, and you know, you have mentors and other people you know have gone on, and they warn you of this. They tell you, you know, your first semester you're going to be just treading water and just doing things for the next day. Even though I was warned, I thought, oh yeah, I'll be better prepared. And I still did it. I still, you know, the exact same stressors and prep for the very next day. Stacy, I wanted to ask about, I mentioned something that you talked about, getting material from other people versus sort of forging ahead with your own, and the give and take of that and how they kind of change over time. So those things that people have sort of handed you slides and said, here's what I did. Have you had more trouble with those than the stuff you've done from scratch, or what's your opinion on that?
So my evolution course was taught by three other people at UAB, including the person that I ended up replacing. And so I had three people's sets of slides, and I ended up not liking any of them. So I redid. I did the course kind of how one of them did it my first semester. And part of my angst was that I didn't like how it was structured. And so the second time I taught it, I overhauled some things, and I think it was better, but I think it was more work up front for my population genetics class to start from scratch. But I think it went better the first time because I didn't have these preconceived ideas. I think in the end, the amount of time probably is the same, but I was just happier, even when stuff went really badly and I messed up something in the first time I taught population genetics, and then I got myself confused, and then the students were confused, and then there was just confusion for 45 minutes, and then the lecture ended, and I just went back and sat in my office with my head on my desk. But I was still happier than the first time I taught evolution. So I think it helps, like especially for the first course that you're going to teach, to have that crutch, I think gives you something to fall back on in case I couldn't get a lecture together, I had one that I could give in a pinch.
Yeah, I would say having someone else's course packet is valuable, not so much for the PowerPoint slides, as for like the curriculum. Mm-hmm. Like the list of here are the topics we're going to cover for the semester. Here's at least one person's idea about what's a logical way to proceed through those. And here are the kinds of activities that make sense for the learning outcomes we want for this class. That stuff is considerably, I think, harder to do than once you have that skeleton together, sitting down and saying, oh, okay, I'm going to talk about this today. Let me do the background reading. Let me put the slides together. And it's nice if there are slides that you can edit from rather than starting from scratch. But often working from someone else's slides, yeah, doesn't feel like it's a big time saver to me.
Yeah, because at the beginning, sort of a lot of the stress is the mystery of what is expected in, mm-hmm. you know, at the university, and then getting to know the students and what the culture is like. I mean, just now I feel much more prepared because I have a basic understanding of what the students are like, what they like to do, what works, what doesn't work for them specifically. And it sort of doesn't matter what the material is, that makes it less stressful no matter what. Do either of you, so I'm assuming that we're all more comfortable now than we were first semester. Do either of you have specific efficiency tips and tricks types things that have made teaching easier for you now? Start with Jeremy, maybe.
Yeah, sure. I'm a big believer in our learning management system for as awful as it feels to say that. It's like plugging Microsoft Excel. But
you're going to get hate mail for that.
I might from all possible sides. We use Canvas, which is one of the behemoth LMSs out there. And it has some things that really still I find really, really obnoxious. I cannot send emails to students from Canvas. I have to go to our other grade management backend to get the list of student emails. But it does so much that could be very time consuming. It automates in a big way. So I do, like, every class period there's a review quiz. That's on Canvas. As long as I write the questions correctly, which is a 95%, let's say, accurate process. Students just log on. They can do multiple choice. They can do matching. They can do an array of reasonably good sort of quickie questions, and that all gets graded automatically. Canvas is actually pretty good for managing writing assignments. There's a speed grader interface, they call it, that if you take the time to set it up, you can view a rubric in one panel and the paper in another panel and just go down the rubric and score things, and it turns into a number that pops up in the gradebook. Mm-hmm. And that's honestly, if I didn't have that, I have a relatively short research paper assignment in my evolution class, which includes a draft phase where students are supposed to turn in something and do mutual peer review, and I also take a look and offer comments. If I couldn't do that, if I were sitting down with even a folder full of files on my desktop, much less like a pile of printouts, I could not manage that for a 70 student class. But I can with Canvas. And the students, you know, these interfaces are widely enough used in the department too that students for the most part come to my 300 level class already familiar enough with the system. There are still technical glitches that drive me a little batty. If I use the secure testing mode to run actual exams over Canvas, there are often issues with image files that get to be irritating pretty quickly if you're trying to do sort of higher level conceptual data interpretation stuff. But for a lot of purposes, figuring out how to use the system and finding all of the ways that it can save me time has made my life a lot easier.
I guess I'm less of a Canvas fan. We use Canvas as well. The thing that I think is a double-edged sword is that we have to have dynamic syllabi. It's one of the provost's rules. So you have to have at least one date that's put into the calendar that somehow gets uploaded to the students' Google calendars. And so I usually have all of the big assignments scheduled. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that leads to some students may be forgetting about some of the assignments because it's not something that they're putting into their own calendars. I have no real evidence of that, but I wonder how auto-filling a lot of that, it's easy to overlook something, especially if you have multiple classes that are doing that sort of thing on Canvas.
Mm-hmm.
But
Go ahead. Oh yeah, so I was going to say one of my recurrent frustrations with Canvas is that I don't have a good intuition for what it looks like from the student's perspective. And I've only slowly become aware that it is kind of presenting this Facebook-like daily feed of stuff. And some students just like do the next thing in the feed, which is the idea. But if there's like, if I have a draft assignment in place, that's the settings are wrong, but there's a, it's got a deadline attached to it that can pop up in their feeds. And like I've had students take quizzes that were not relevant to the material that hadn't actually been assigned yet, but because it was accidentally public, it popped up and they were like, oh, I guess I'm doing this now, even though we always do these in the beginning of class and it's a Tuesday and we don't have class today. And it's not like, you know, it looks like I made that assignment. And so they're trying to keep up with it.
Yeah, I've taken to now putting the dates in so that I'm in compliance with being on a dynamic syllabus, but then also physically writing the dates out like in an old school syllabus that you could print. Mm-hmm. Because then I print that and then use that to fill in my handwritten calendar so I don't forget stuff. And then that's how I also catch if I put something on the wrong date. Because some of the back end of Canvas I don't find terribly intuitive, mm-hmm. but I also didn't use some sort of management system when I was an undergrad. So I wonder if it'll be a little bit easier to navigate if you were used to using something like that. But the thing that I learned when I was teaching last spring, I taught my population genetics class and biometry, and then I got my summer covered for doing like double my normal load in the spring. And that was 3:30 to 4:45 for population genetics, and then 5 to 6:15 for biometry on Tuesdays and Thursdays. It was
brutal.
Yeah.
I don't want to complain too much after seeing like a Arun's schedule, so it really wasn't that bad, but it felt horrible to me. And I learned at that point that I wasn't going to let perfection be an enemy. I'm just going to do the best that I could do. And hopefully the students got something out of my lecture. But I think I've learned over time, and this has been hard won, that I can just do the best that I can do in a lecture. And if I spend 10 hours doing redoing a lecture, that it doesn't necessarily make that lecture that much better from what it was. And the other piece of advice I got, I was like memorizing all of my lectures and practicing them several times. And then some of the other faculty were like, you don't use notes? It's like, are we allowed to use notes? And so then once somebody said, yeah, I take notes, I thought, well, great. Then I took notes. And then my stress level, I think there was an order of magnitude that I felt less stressed. And I don't even use the notes that much, but just like having notes has been really nice, especially teaching biometry, because that I think was the hardest course that I've taught. Just I understand it, but communicating statistics to grad students and teaching them R at the same time was just, it was really, really hard.
Is that desire to have the presentation perfect, is that like a lingering job market, going to conferences sort of situation, or is it just you wanting to nail it in the classroom? Like, I understand that your context for presentations when you're a postdoc is much different than when you're in front of a classroom. Do you think that just took time to go away, or is it something else?
I think it's probably both. Like, I wanted to do a good job. The reality is that UAB being the best teacher in the world doesn't matter if I don't bring in a lot of grants. So I want to be a very good teacher, but I also can't let that be the enemy of doing what most of my time is supposed to be spent doing, mentoring graduate students and postdocs and generating data. But I think it was also just, it had been a long time since I had been in a classroom, like as a student. And then all of a sudden I was thrown back in, and at UAB people are pretty formal as well. And so in France, you're pretty much first name basis, where I did my PhD, the same in the UK. And then at CSUN, like all of my professors there, I was on a first name basis with. I was an undergrad in a lab, but I would never call them Dr. somebody. And then when I got to UAB, it's Dr. all the time. And so that also took some adjustment. And now I do typically like have undergrads refer to me as Dr. Kruger Hadfield because it didn't go so well when I tried to be Stacy. But that was, I think it was just the formal nature. People are more dressed up when they lecture. And I think that might be also from the medical school that people tend to be more suit and tie down the street. And so I dressed up a lot in the beginning. And then I was like, this is ridiculous. I'm not wearing like slacks and a blazer every day. So now I compromise with like a blazer and jeans.
Oh yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, so we're very informal here. I mean, it's a very progressive, intensely so, you know, small liberal arts community out in the middle of nowhere. And for me, it really clicked when it was clear that the students, you know, in my upper level courses especially, were used to not being able to hide from faculty, and discussions really were discussions. You know, you were expected to say something and voice your opinion, and that was just normal, standard. It's not trying to like extract someone say something in a, you know, lecture hall of 60 people. It was just much different. And again, those, you know, learning about the culture was so important for designing, you know, designing courses. If something's not working, we can just get in groups and talk about it, and that's okay. What about, so I think we should probably cover, you know, the elephant in the room about how our teaching has adapted to going online in a COVID-19 academia period here, how that transition's happened for you and how much you're disliking it, I guess is probably the best way to phrase the question.
So my course, I'm teaching population genetics. And it was at the point in the semester, I front load this course because it doesn't have a lab yet. I'm hoping that I'll be able to develop a lab for it where we can spend a lot more time actually generating data, extracting DNA, and then analyzing those data. But for the moment, I have to balance a 15-week semester where we meet twice a week for an hour and 15 minutes between giving them the background that they need through lectures to then actually analyze some data that I give them. And so we front load the semester with a bunch of lectures, giving them the theory, and then we spend the second half of the semester analyzing data. And their final exam is actually going, finding a paper that has available data and recreating a number of figures or tables, depending on how complicated it is to make that figure or that table. It might be one figure, it might be three figures or two tables or whatever. And so we were at the point in the semester where we only had two lectures left, and the rest of the time was computer-based lab time. And in one regard, it was easy in the sense that I didn't need to record a bunch of lectures, and it was easier in that sense on the students that they didn't have to be there at a certain time or have to watch these like 45-minute Zoom lectures of some professor trying to figure out like how not to be an idiot on Zoom giving a lecture. So that was easy, but the hard part has been how to make sure that the students have access to everything. When I've taught this before, students who've had computer issues, which I've had several students have computer issues, they've been able to come and use the Mac in my lab that has parallels so they can do both PC and Mac-based things, and now they don't have that option. And so fortunately now they've started to take advantage of my office hours where I'm on Zoom. And so they share their screens with me and I'm trying to teach them like things in R, and it's just not the same as sitting next to someone and showing them. And I've found it's been really a challenge. And when you're teaching a course that you plan online, you're just going to plan it totally differently than a course that you've planned to have a lot of interaction and sitting around each other when somebody doesn't understand what's happening in R, then another student can help them. And all of that is just completely out the window now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so mine, my spring course has been a pretty similar experience, actually. So my willingness to use Canvas has paid pretty big dividends in that, like, a lot of the infrastructural stuff I had to do to make the course possible online was already done. Quizzes and tests and some class activities are managed through there already. I was already delivering the day's slides in Canvas modules. So students were all familiar with that to begin with. But it's a lab and a field course as well. And we only did 2 of 4 planned field trips before we had to go to not in-person classes. So I've essentially eliminated the field trip component, or I've dramatically reduced it. There's now a, what I did was I created an extra credit assignment where I described how a student could, some things a student could do to take a self-guided field trip and to go to some appropriate place and hike around and look for plants. And then report on that experience in a structured way. And I, over the first week of the lockdown preparation, I generated a list of possible places that students could go. We've got lots of hiking trails coming right out adjacent to the city. Lots of nice natural areas in greater Los Angeles, and a couple of great botanical gardens as well. And basically, over the course of the period where we were offline to retool for online learning, which was our spring break, I watched each of these options be eliminated for social distancing reasons. The Huntington Botanical Garden first went to gardens only and then closed altogether. I think Los Angeles City Parks had not closed hiking trails, but the conservancy that manages a lot of the hiking trails outside of the city closed those down as we were reopening for online classes. And so I've had to adjust my expectations for what kinds of places students could go for those experiences. And it's an extra credit assignment, so nobody is going to fail the class if they can't manage it. They just don't have that experience. The lab component of the course was always very sort of descriptive botanical, looking at fresh specimens, getting hands-on experience with the things we were talking about, and that is just, I've not been able to replicate that. There's a lot of we are still getting emails from companies that have created virtual lab modules and whatnot, and sorry, there's not a way to meaningfully interact with fresh plants in a virtual setting, to the best of my knowledge.
I think that from the very beginning it was real, and I'd love to hear your experience of this too. From the beginning, it was really clear that many of our students, they were just headed for a crazy diversity of places. Some were sticking around, some were going other places, some wouldn't have internet, some would be taking care of family members or getting a job while they're home. And it just became clear so rapidly that we couldn't have the same expectations for them, and that it quickly became a strategies of reduction, not necessarily different ways to teach the same things. How do we boil it down to what's important and make it approachable for students in these scenarios? And I imagine, Jeremy in LA, that this was a big problem there too.
Actually, less than you might think. So we're a predominantly commuter campus, There are CSUs that have even fewer resident students than we do, but we have a lot of students who live within commuting distance of the campus and are not living on campus. So there were not the same kind of mass dorm closing upheavals, although for some there were, but for the bulk of campus, that wasn't the issue. I did have one student in Flower and Plant Systematics who was on exchange from the University of Minnesota, who is back in the Twin Cities. She's going to mail me her copy of the Jepsum Manual at some point. But for the most part, that kind of logistics hasn't been the concern so much as just like students' lives are, of course, being upended because they mostly can't leave the house. The flip side of our being a commuter campus is lots of students have work commitments that they may be trying to navigate in some capacity with the lockdown conditions, lots of them are helping to take care of kids who are not in school because our schools have been closed and operating remotely, as well as universities.
I'd say UAB is kind of like CSUN, that we do have residents, then we also have a lot of commuters. We're not as residentially oriented as Tuscaloosa, which is just 45 minutes away. Okay. But there's been a lot of upheaval with students just maybe not having internet access or not having fast enough internet access to watch videos. So I just made all of the rest of the materials for class, like the four labs that they had to complete with data to analyze, just available over spring break and said, here, try to work on this. And my mm-hmm. expectations for what they turn in are not going to be the same as in class, because some of them haven't reached out. And I don't know if they haven't reached out because they haven't had time, because they are doing other stuff, or they're so lost they don't even know where to start. So as long as people make a valid effort, then I'll consider that to be the best of a bad job that was completely beyond their control and my control.
Yeah. We're all struggling through it together, at least for the foreseeable future.
Go ahead. I'm gesturing about the time, but the other thought I had was that it's just really disappointing to be interacting with my students in this way.
Yes.
Like Flowering Plants is a forward level class. It's bio majors who are really interested in the subject for the most part. And this semester particularly, has just been a lot of really good engaged students. And I really liked, we had some great field trip experiences. I was enjoying working with them. And I felt like I knew the students in the lab in a way that I don't always. And now I'm interacting with them twice a week over Zoom, and I know they're mostly attending, they're signing on, but I don't hear from students who I would at least say hi to and answer some questions from in an in-person setting, and that's sad.
That's by far the hardest part for me. I mean, I get so much energy from being in the classroom and getting to know the students, and in a good classroom period, you know, I get back to my office and I'm jazzed up, it's exciting, and totally have that missing doing any sort of online lecturing or you know, and we're mostly asynchronous because of these limitations that students have. And so it's by far been the hardest part.
Yeah, I would agree. That just, even when they overcome a problem in R, like in my class, or even using Genelex or something, or like playing with Sanger sequencing data, and they don't get it, and then all of a sudden they get it. But then I had a student on Zoom right before we started this who figured something out. And it was just kind of like, good job. Goodbye. And just not the same as if you're in class and people are able to make connections with the things that you've been talking about in lecture. It's not the same.
Yeah, so if any of our students ever hear this, we miss you. We really do like you and like talking to you. You heard it here first. But so these new PI chats, we're hoping that the podcast is a new home for these in the future. And we especially want to get out of our own heads and talk to the people who read the blog. And so we want folks to be looking at social media. We're going to have some instructions on the blog post page for this podcast episode, as well as on social media, for how you can submit questions or ideas for what we're doing here. And we're looking forward to bringing in some guest speakers in the future as well. I really want to thank Jeremy Yoder, Stacy Kruger Hadfield. I'm Rob Denton. Till next time.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
You can find a link to submit questions and suggestions for upcoming new PI chats on the show notes for this episode at molecularecologist.com. And that's where you can also find lots more writing about ecology, evolution, and everything in between from all of today's panelists. You can follow updates from The Molecular Ecologist on Twitter at @MOLEcologist, or find us on Facebook by searching for The Molecular Ecologist. The Molecular Ecologist podcast is produced by Turning on Zoom and Hoping for the Best, and it's hosted on anchor.fm. It's available via Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, and Spotify, or you can get the RSS feed direct from anchor.fm. If you've enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to rate it or even leave a review.